Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Endowment, working to build healthier communities that support children, youth, and families. Online at www.calendow.org. And OSH, Complete Home and Garden, offering service and selection to Californians for over 75 years. Ideas, tips, and solutions at osh.com.
From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. I'm Juan Ha, in for Scott Schaefer. Coming up, newsrooms across the state are shrinking, but the ethnic press tells a different story.
I think the tremors that are going through mainstream newspapers, you're not seeing that in ethnic print media.
Plus, robots, gizmos, and whatever the heck that thing is, they and their imaginative creators are the attractions at a unique fair that wants to bring out the do-it-yourselfer in you.
So what I just did is I took four pink gumballs, which are currently mapped to bass drum, and laid them at the four downbeats across the measure.
And we'll take a peek at Tobias Wolff's new book and hear how Irish music is attracting new fans across the state. Those stories next on the California Report. Plummeting circulation and ad revenue is behind a steady drumbeat of staff cuts at California's major newspapers. This week, the Orange County Register announced it will cut as many as 90 jobs. That's 5% of its workforce. But not all newspapers are hurting. Last year, 200,000 foreign-born immigrants moved to California, and many read newspapers in their native languages. That's a big reason why much of the ethnic press is thriving. LA Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz takes a closer look.
At a popular cafe in Orange County's Little Saigon neighborhood, old Vietnamese men smoke cigarettes and discuss the day's news. At Ngoc Tran's table, there's a lot to talk about. Four different newspapers share table space with their coffee. All of them are published here in this neighborhood.
Even with the people that have enough language to read the American newspaper, but we still favor the Vietnamese newspaper.
World news? Check. State and local news? Check. These publications cover everything the LA Times covers and more. They're written in Vietnamese, they carry Vietnamese angles on current events, and they provide up-to-date news from Vietnam. Their popularity means that Little Saigon, population 150,000, has at least 43 local newspapers and news magazines. A growing number of Hispanic consumers are also reading ethnic papers.
They are the personification of niche media.
Sandy Close is director of New America Media, an association of more than 700 ethnic media organizations.
I think the tremors that are going through mainstream newspapers, you're not seeing that in ethnic print media. And to the extent now everything that seems to have a return on investment in media has to be hyper-local, they are already there.
A nationwide survey conducted by Close's organization found the ethnic media reaches 51 million Americans, a sixth of the U.S. population. 8 million Californians, or a quarter of the state, regularly consume ethnic news sources. Close says while many big advertisers are pulling ads out of mainstream newspapers, they're continuing to advertise in local foreign language newspapers. But that doesn't mean that ethnic newspapers are flush with cash.
If we're lucky, we make a profit.
39-year-old Nina Lay is the publisher of Viet Bao, one of the few daily Vietnamese language newspapers with a national audience. It has a circulation of 100,000. Though Viet Bao carries a range of advertisers, they're not charging mainstream newspaper rates. And that's not the only drag on her budget.
The expectation from our readers are very high as well. As a media company, we've been taking phone call for, you know, different kind of services. How do you apply to get a driver license? You know, how do I, you know, get my ticket erased?
As is the case for many foreign language newspapers, most of Viet Bao's readers speak limited English, so the paper is not only a news source, it's also a de facto community center. Lay sees this complimentary service as her duty to readers, but it forces her staff to wear many hats. But not as many hats as smaller publishers in Little Saigon wear. Take Truk Kin Lee, for example.
I am the publisher. I am the editor-in-chief. I am the photographer. I am the reporter. I am the writer. I am the marketing. And I am the delivery.
And when he's not doing all of that, Lee runs his own restaurant. He spends half of his day here at his vegetarian eatery and the other half putting together Van Hoa, a monthly news and literary magazine that's distributed to Vietnamese communities worldwide. Lee can't afford to pay his correspondents for their articles. He has to think like a fox in order to have an edge on his competition. When he scored an exclusive interview with Vietnam's former prime minister a few years ago, he says he allowed the rest of the Vietnamese media to cover the event with the stipulation that only he got to ask the questions. The widely broadcasted interview generated unprecedented publicity for his magazine. While mainstream magazines pay for photos taken by wire service photographers, Lee, like many ethnic publishers, doesn't bother. If he needs them, he'll just take them off the internet. I'm not afraid of being sued, he says in Vietnamese. I spent 8 years of hell in a Vietnamese prison camp. Nothing can faze me. Lee takes me across the street to his magazine office, located between shops at a mini mall. After working at the restaurant until 9 at night, he comes straight here to work on the magazine. He gives me a tour of his office.
This is a layout computer, design computer. It's printing. It's my bag.
You sleep here? you sleep in your office?
Yeah. Because I don't go back to my house.
Lee sleeps in his office bed for about 4 hours a night. The news, he says, never sleeps. For the California Report, I'm Rob Schmitz in Los Angeles.
For many of us, the county fair conjures up images of carnival rides, the sweet taste of cotton candy, and the earthy smells of farm animals. Well, San Mateo County offers a different twist on this tradition. The attractions at this weekend's Maker Fair are objects that you won't find on store shelves. The fair is a celebration of creativity and imagination. And that's why mainstream manufacturers are among those checking it out. Reporter Lisa Morehouse has this preview.
Let's make this clear. The Maker Fair is not some little craft show. It's really a celebration of contemporary do-it-yourselfers, from knitters and techies to woodworkers and hackers.
When you make something, you get to make choices there that a marketing person didn't make for you.
Dale Doherty publishes Make and Craft magazines, sponsors of the Maker Faire.
You get to control that process just like an artist. And so what you make is very personal.
Personal and inclusive. Doherty says there's a place for almost everyone who tinkers at the Maker Faire.
We'll just start from scratch and build one up for you.
That's Andrew McDermott, a master's student at UC Berkeley's School of Information. He is building an electronic music composition with a gumball sequencer, made up of a computer, a camera, and brightly colored gumballs on a tabletop grid.
So what I just did is I took four pink gumballs, which are currently mapped to bass drum, and laid them at the four downbeats across the measure.
A digital camera mounted under the grid detects the color and location of the gumballs, which trigger different drum sounds. McDermott and his classmate Hannes Hesse created the gumball sequencer, which has been viewed 100,000 times on YouTube. They'll be showing it off live this weekend. Hannes Hesse.
So I'm taking the cup with the collapse, that's yellow gumballs, and I'm going to put two down on the grid for the two and the four.
Why a gumball sequencer? Hesse and McDermott wanted to make electronic music interactive.
Like often you see people performing really good music, but they look like they're checking email. And so we want to bring that sort of performative element back into dance music. And so here you have an open and inviting surface where people can see what you're doing. It's very transparent.
All that kind of conversation is sort of the heart of Maker Faires.
Make publisher Dale Doherty.
It's not a gallery setting. It's not an exhibition with objects on display. It's people. It's the makers. And that's the heart and soul of the fair.
You'll want to wear comfy shoes if you visit the Maker Fair. Projects will fill the San Mateo County Fairgrounds and even spill into its parking lot. You can make things with your kids or friends in the play day area, watch a life-size mousetrap game, and explore 10 themed indoor areas like Robo Games and the Dark Room. There's also the Swap-a-Rama-Rama, where the creative ladies from San Francisco's Stitch Lounge hold court. For a lot of makers, there's an anti-consumerist, pro-environment motivation for what they do. And though Stitch Lounge's Hope Meng is a seamstress, she loves seeing computers running on vegetable oil and vans decorated with cast-off Macs.
It's just incredible seeing that same kind of refashioning spirit that we put towards clothing put towards electronics or wood carving or whatever.
This year, Meng will teach visitors to sew items from recycled fabric, like this arm warmer she's making now.
Taking an old sweater that doesn't fit me anymore, and I'm going to cut it off at the sleeve.
Meng cuts, pins, and stitches, and in fewer than 5 minutes, creates a cute arm sleeve.
And voila!
This culture of reimagination, Doherty says, touches a nerve in our society, with creative communities popping up in neighborhoods and online.
We believe that we're on to something here that tells us a lot about the future. And to some degree, these makers are doing things that we think more and more people will be doing in the future.
Big industry is certainly paying attention. Engineers from companies like GM and John Deere will attend the fair, engaging with makers and finding out what innovations can come from creative thinkers. For the California Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse.
You've got to check out the gumball sequencer in action. We've got a link to the video on our website, californiareport.org. Since the 1980s, Tobias Wolff has been a leading literary voice in contemporary literature. He's best known for his award-winning memoir, This Boy's Life, which was turned into a movie starring Leonardo DiCaprio and Robert De Niro. But what's distinguished the Stanford creative writing professor is his fiction. A new collection of his short stories shows why. Oscar Villalone has this review.
Tobias Wolff, as his memoirs would point out, has led an unusual life. He went from a difficult adolescence in Washington to an elite boarding school in Pennsylvania, from being a grunt in Vietnam to an English student at Oxford. He is also among the most notable of American writers to have once received the Stegner Fellowship at Stanford, joining the illustrious company of such writers as the late poet and short story master Raymond Carver. What has earned Wolff the right to be considered, along with Carver, who was a close friend, as one of the finest of our modern writers, is the exquisiteness of his prose and, especially, the variety of experiences his work explores. The military and academia, lives of comfortable ease or anxious subsistence, the landscapes of California and the Northwest, all of these worlds and settings are gathered in Our Story Begins, a collection of some of Wolff's past short fiction, as well as his most recent pieces. Reading these selected stories, one can't help but notice how well-conceived Wolff's artistic vision was from the start, beginning with his first book, In the Garden of the North American Martyrs, from 1981. The concerns of that vision can be neatly summed up in the words of the youthful narrator in the story Flyboys. Taken aback by the powerful sorrow of a friend's mother, he realizes he was, quote, even more appalled by her attempts to overcome it, because they so plainly, pathetically failed. And in failing, opened up the view of a world I had only begun to suspect, where wounds did not heal and things did not work out for the best. How we navigate an existence that can't help but be pitted by heartbreak, even meanness and cruelty, is what Our Story Begins tries to make sense of. As his characters, many of them strangers to their emotions and desires, try to come to terms with the immutable human condition, Wolff regales us with stories sometimes warmed with grace and forgiveness, sometimes chilled by violence and despair. This is where his spare prose serves him so well. Controlled, crafted, concrete, Wolff's sentences are a marvel. If he were a jazz musician, he'd be of the same school as Miles Davis, playing only the right note at the right time. It's not so much that Wolff embraces spare writing for its own sake, but that he carefully chooses his words for effect. The results are anything but minimalist. Here's a scene from his story, The Rich Brother. The trees gave way to fields. Pete drove on between metal fences plastered with wind-blown scraps of paper. Tool fog hung above the ditches, spilling into the road, dimming the ghostly halogen lights that burned in the yards of the farms he passed. The fog left beads of water rolling up the windshield. These sorts of lush descriptions, along with Wolf's eye for gestures and inflections, make his fiction nuanced and vivid. This is why, along with the occasional shot of humor, we don't buckle under the otherwise heavy themes of wrong turns and near misses. Further bracing us are the flashes of hope and redemption in the collection, especially in Wolf's newer stories, where mercy and self-forgiveness go a long way in taking the sting out of existence. Our story begins, never leaves us in doubt as to how precious life is, and how art can be made of its many bafflements.
Oscar Villalon is the book editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. He reviewed The Story Begins by Tobias Wolf. We always like to get your feedback about what you hear on the California Report. Last week, guest host Rachel Miro highlighted summer rock, country, and jazz music festivals with her critics Steve Hockman and Andrew Gilbert. But we got this message from a listener who thought we should have included another genre as well.
Hi there. My name is Tom, and I'm a very loyal listener, a bit distressed by the California Report I just heard. The host, she covered almost every type of music, every genre except classical music. I think that she missed out by not talking about the classical music genre, so I just wanted to point that out.
Indeed, we stuck to mainly rock, jazz, and country in our roundup. But don't fret, classical fans. We've got some links to classical music festivals on our website, californiareport.org. Did you hear something that got you thinking? Send your comments and story ideas to calreport@kqed.org. That's calreport@kqed.org. A California appeals court recently ruled that parents who homeschool their children need to have a teaching credential. The ruling triggered a public uproar, and the case is being reheard. But all of that attention brought a little secret to light. Homeschoolers in California operate under the radar with few academic requirements and little oversight. And as David Gorn reports, that may be just how many homeschoolers want it.
No one can give an exact figure, but one homeschool association estimate says that 166,000 children are taught at home in California. The State Department of Education guesses it's about half that. It's not clear exactly how many there are or how well these students are doing because no one is monitoring all of them. The one thing that is clear is the number of homeschoolers has been growing. But here's the thing, says Steve Sugarman, a UC Berkeley law professor. Homeschooling may be popular, but that doesn't mean it's entirely legal.
Under the California law, if you homeschool your children as opposed to put them in school, you have to have a credential. That's the formal law on the books.
In fact, Sugarman says, California law gives you three choices. Children can be enrolled in public school, in private school, or taught by someone with a teaching credential. That's it. Nothing in there about homeschooling by parents. The recent state court ruling that said parents need a teaching credential that caused such a fuss, that, says Sugarman, simply upheld existing law.
So the judge decided something that has been California law for quite some time.
Up in Sacramento, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger said he would consider changing that law to protect homeschoolers. And State Assemblyman Joel Anderson of El Cajon stopped short of proposing a new law, but he has sponsored an assembly resolution condemning the ruling and praising homeschooling.
It's not for the state to tell parents how to raise their children or how to educate their children.
Anderson, who was homeschooled himself and who has three homeschooled children, says his bill makes a simple statement that homeschooling has been successful in California for decades and that it's ridiculous to attack it now.
It simply is acknowledging 30 years of successful homeschooling here in California, and we're asking the courts not to muck it up.
Delaine Easton is the former superintendent of schools in California and now a professor at Mills College in Oakland. Back in 2002, as superintendent, she tried to establish some baseline standards for homeschooling.
We have a responsibility to make sure that their rights as parents don't infringe on their children's rights to a great education.
But Easton met with heated resistance. She says she's not against homeschools, but teaching is a skill, and some parents may be overmatched. For instance, in trying to handle advanced physics or trigonometry instruction, if children have a fundamental right to an education in California, she says, shouldn't the state make sure in some way that happens?
Well, if we are so up in arms about making sure every public school kid learns, what are we going to do to make sure every kid that's homeschooled learns?
In the coastal city of Santa Cruz, a complex of buildings houses four different alternative schools. One of those schools is a hybrid of a public school and a home school. This is the future of homeschooling, says Administrator Hakate Rosewood, as she walks through the school's learning center, crammed full of textbooks and computers and art materials. Parents use this center as a base, she says, to get everything they need to teach their kids, including credentialed instruction. The method of learning varies widely, she says, but the outcomes have one thing in common.
Every child who's taken the California exit exam has passed it and graduated. We don't have a dropout rate. We don't have kids who don't graduate because of not making the graduation requirements.
And from an administrative standpoint, the public school gets the daily attendance money from the state, and the parents get as much structure as they're comfortable with. Homeschool parents can be antagonistic toward public school, but Rosewood says that's not the case where she works, and that the mutual cooperation between private parents and public school has paid off for kids.
I think that this is an amazing program, that it produces some of the most thoughtful and creative young people that I've ever seen.
Homeschooling has become part of the fabric of education in California, and now even a part of the public school system. UC Berkeley Law Professor Steve Sugarman says that changing the law would probably mean setting some kind of universal standard, and that's one reason those who homeschool have not been pushing for a new law. And Sugarman says they may not need to.
Homeschooling has been left alone until this case. So why force an issue to be decided when people seem basically content?
Whether homeschooling will still be left alone or not will be decided at a rehearing by the state appellate court in June. For the California Report, I'm David Gorn.
At the dimly lit Plow in the Stars pub in San Francisco, three men perform on a small stage. One plays the fiddle, another's on guitar, and a third plays the flute. They're part of Tipsy House, a traditional Irish band. Men and women partner up on the dance floor, while at the bar, folks tap their feet to the music.
We see music as something that's put on a stage and it's performance for an audience. In Ireland, this music and this dance and everything, it isn't like that. It's more like everybody gets together and celebrates the music.
Jack Gilder's the co-founder of Tipsy House. The band's been playing for over a decade. Irish immigrants first brought this music to the U.S. in the 17th century. Passed down from musician to musician, it's evolved over time and continues to draw a devoted following in places like San Francisco, Santa Monica, and Monterey.
It's really nice as a person living in California or the States, you can go and visit these places and you instantly have camaraderie with people that you may only see every once in a while or you may never have met, and you can sit down and play tunes, and it's just a great pastime.
A couple of weeks later, Gilder is back at the pub. But this time, he's part of a group of musicians gathered for a weekly session. It's a full ensemble with a penny whistle, fiddle, accordion, banjo, mandolin, boron, Ilian pipes, and the Irish flute. At first glance, sessions look casual. But there are unwritten rules. Musicians should follow the person who leads the tune and not play too loud. They're also expected to keep up with the melody line. Although sessions are mostly instrumental, they sometimes inspire people to sing. Barman Paul Matthews steps up to sing Bon Fagin, a song about lost love. The line between the audience and the musicians is blurred at sessions. People in the crowd can sit close to the action while musicians take breaks to mingle. Kristen Tiash lives up the street from the Plow in the Stars.
We really liked sitting at the table, and we were literally like right next to all of the musicians, you know, feeling like we were sort of part of their circle, you know. And my friend Jenny actually got a little bit of an instruction from the man that was playing the drum.
Dublin native Connell O'Reilly plays the Ilian pipes and the tin whistle, but tonight he's just watching the session.
My father played the fiddle, and so I've always listened to the music and loved it, and always assumed it was too late to start playing, and came across some musicians in San Francisco who started when they were a bit older as well, and that kind of inspired me to realize it's not too late, and, you know, it's never too late, really.
Irish traditional music is not just a hobby. For some, it can easily turn into an obsession. Richard Mandel plays the guitar for Tipsy House.
Usually any relationship they're in ends, their personal hygiene starts to deteriorate, and their sleeping habits become minimal, and they spend pretty much every waking hour learning tunes.
If you want to get a taste of this music, check out the Irish pub near you. Chances are there's a session playing tonight. And that's our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. Tom Kramkowski is behind the controls today. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman and Dan Bringer. The online editor is Gabriel Cohen. Our interns are Ali Tabatabai, Harry Gregory, Leanne Lucetta, and June Stinson, who produced our postcard on Irish music. Joey Peters and Willie Aaron composed our theme. The producer is Victoria Malione. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. Bruce Kuhn is the news director. I'm Juan Ha. Scott Schaefer returns next week. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the Wesley Foundation for coverage of immigration issues throughout California, and the California Healthcare Foundation and Cal Hospital Compare, rating hospital quality in California. On the web at calhospitalcompare.org.